Welcome back to episode 132 of Chess Journeys, Tales of Adult Improvement. Here in Chess Journeys, we love to explore the highs and glories of ratings gain, but we also dive into the norm, the plateaus, and even sometimes below that, the pits of despair. If you want to support the show, you can go to Patreon Chess Journeys. I want to thank our queen level supporters, Blundergoat, Tim Everett, Scott B4, D6 Joe, Matt Bush, Jay Garrison, Donna Rich Burgess, Brandon Hallside, Jeff Peterson, Tobias Rex, Bob Berger, Nicholas Harrigan, Rich, Bradley Fenner, Fletcher Ray, Nathan Peterson, Christian Glaw, and King level supporter Ian Samples. If you want to appear on the show, a great way to do that is to fill out the Google form in the show notes. We all want to hear your story. Our guest today did that. You can also DM me on Twitter. That works as well. And if you're interested in getting better at chess, which I think you are, you can always check out Noel Studer's Next Level Training Program. And there is a code in the show notes below. It helps you. It helps me. We all win as we get better at chess. Well, let's get on to business of today. We have Anna. They're a dedicated chess improver who focuses on over-the-board play. Anna, welcome to the show. And have you had a chance to play any chess yet today?
Hello, Kevin. I love being here. I'm very hyped for this interview, and thank you for having me. I actually have played a couple of moves in a friendly correspondence game. Ooh. I woke up, blundered the bishop, and started my day.
What a terrible start to your day.
Honestly, the hardest part is me coping that I will have to play a two-day-per-move correspondence game down a bishop. Ugh. Against a person who doesn't even care about chess. We're just playing for fun.
I think I'd be tempted to just resign that game and be like, all right, I'm done.
I was 30% about to do that, but then I realized they don't care. I don't care. Can I work some magic?
Okay. There we go. I was looking at a Paul Morphy game with my daughter the other day. We like to go through Morphy's games. And we got to this really weird position where it was like rook e1 check. And we're like, what? You can't make that move. There's a knight in the way. So we kept going through the game. It was only like 12 moves. And I was like, I don't understand. Is this a misprint? And what I forgot to read is it says, Morphy spotted his opponent a knight. So that's why the knight was not there. Morphy wasn't even using that knight. So my point is, Anna, you don't need that bishop. Be like Morphy. Go defeat your opponent down a piece. It's fine.
Thank you so much. I actually don't, because it was my bad bishop. That thought just allows me to sleep better, I guess. Yes, I mainly play over the board, I have to say. My last game was on Wednesday. It was a crushing 13-move defeat. Ooh, okay. I got wrecked by a person who had just taken some lessons on the Queen D6 Scandinavia, in which I have zero knowledge, and I proved that over the board successfully.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess I'm going to ask you about openings. Do you feel like very often that you lose in the opening? And in that game, did you feel like you lost to like opening prep, or is it more like you didn't understand the middle game after you finished that opening?
I tend to heavily dislike openings. I have to say that. I do not like that they are so well mapped out. That had nothing to do with my defeat, that being said. I kind of blundered the bishop. Again, a bishop. I have to mention this.
You don't like your bishops.
I do, but I also like gaining tempos and stuff. But if it's a pawn, I guess it's not worth it. Okay. Anyways, I tend to feel strongly about some openings. Honestly, a lot of openings, even though I don't like studying them. Maybe that's why I feel strongly. I usually face a huge issue realizing where my pieces have to go or what my pawn structure needs to be, stuff in that ballpark. If I can have some time to figure out maybe a game plan, or I've seen a setup or something that can help me through that, I usually can grasp my moves fairly quickly. In that game, I have a huge issue because my opponent was like 500 points above me. So, and they were playing an opening they had just started with a GM. So it was a little bit of a, even if I spent the time to figure out where my pieces should go, I'd be 40 minutes behind.
Yeah.
And then can I successfully survive time pressure with an opponent rated much higher than me. It didn't look good, I have to say.
Yeah. It feels like when I play an opponent 500 points higher than me, it doesn't matter what opening they're playing or who they studied it with. I'm in big trouble already.
Fair point. Although I have managed to beat up to, I don't know, like maybe, I'm not sure I've done 500. I've definitely done 400 points before.
Nice.
Okay. I tend to play we don't have sections basically here in Greece.
Okay.
There are usually, at best, you can find them below 1600 or something like that. And usually there are not enough people to fill both sections, so we end up playing a mixed format. So that means you beat up on a lower level player one round, you get beat up the next round. And if you can upset that balance, then you get to the upper echelons and you start gaining a lot of points.
Yeah, I've been wrestling with that myself at our club. We also just have an open section. It's only once a week, so it's not a big tournament. But this tournament is one of those up and down things where 1 week I played someone rated 1100, and then the next week it's like 1900. But the problem with that is when you play an 1100 and a 1900 and you win one and lose one, you lose a lot of points because the rating average is much lower than yours. And so I'm like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do, guys. I beat the person I was supposed to beat. I lost to the person I was supposed to lose to, and I'm going to lose 30 points? Come on.
Yeah, you're getting stolen. You're clearly getting stolen some points over there. Yeah, I'm not in the upper echelon. So when I play a lower rated and a higher rated, I'm closer to the lower rated. Plus, we're going to get a big reset in 2 months. I don't know if you've heard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not as exciting for me because my FIDE rating in the US, it's so hard with FIDE because the kids are already underrated and then their FIDE ratings are just like hilarious, right? Like they'll be rated 1800 USCF and you play them and you're like, okay, you were really underrated. And then you're like, what was your FIDE rating? And they're like 700 and you're like, wait, what? Or like 1000 or whatever the minimum is, you know? And it's just because they played one time like 3 years ago and it's madness. So it will be exciting to get like 150 points or something, but my FIDE rating will still be terrible. How about you? Is your FIDE rating going to surge?
I mean, yeah, and it's supposed to be a good thing, but I kind of had my aims and my goals with the old system. So I'm kind of attached, shall we say, if that makes sense.
Okay, so what is your rating now then?
So I in the survey I did respond 1200 by heart and I do at heart, I'm sorry, and I do stand by it. I will explain later. For FIDE, I should be about 1300 plus something, depending on the results.
Okay. And then what was your goal then?
So I had a lot of childhood friends. They played as kids, they continued to play as kids, and they got better. They reached about 1500, which was 1500 10 years ago. So it doesn't, it's not the same as today,
yeah.
I have to say.
Yeah.
But I kind of want to reach 1500 FIDE so I can say that I am starting my journey, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, congratulations. You're going to be 1500 in 2 months.
I
you
mean,
reached
that's true.
Your goal.
Yes, I'm going to actually celebrate that. Although, to be fair, 1500 will equal 1700 if I'm not mistaken, but I will take some time off to celebrate that for sure.
Well, that's pretty amazing. Getting to wake up and reach your goal without playing. That's the greatest way ever to get rating points is sleeping. You're like, I slept great last night and they gave me 150 points for my good night's sleep.
Oh, that's true. But it shouldn't be as little as 150. It should be like 300 or something. The maximum amount is 400.
The maximum is 400? Oh my god.
Yeah, because it takes the base from 1,000 to 1,400.
Ah, okay. There we go. All right. Well, maybe it'll be even higher. I don't know. Excellent. All right. Well, let's go back all the way and look at, like, when did you learn chess? Did you learn chess as a kid at all from some relative in your family or a friend, or did you just learn it for the first time more recently?
So I did play as a child. Up to being a preteen, I used to play chess in a chess club. I do not remember how I was taught. there's a decent chance that it involved my father. And there's also a decent chance that it involved a book, which I still have. It's a very cute book, honestly.
Ooh.
I used to play with my brother mainly, if not completely, at least during my first days before the chess club. And in the chess club, it was very, very nice, very fun. Unfortunately, we did not have the means to hire a private coach at the time. Even though I showed some promise, I was also not very, we can call it encouraged, we can call it aware of what studying actually meant. I was a child that just played chess with my friends, basically.
Yeah.
I wasn't too bad and I didn't fall too much behind, but I would have liked to have accomplished more in that, you know, that span.
Okay, so you would go to the club. Did you play many tournaments or anything like that as a kid?
I played in team tournaments. I didn't play in actual tournaments where you join by yourself.
Okay.
Which is a contrast to how I approach tournaments these days and how most people do, I have to say. But there is a system with all these team tournaments in Greece where a lot of kids play each other every week. It's very nice, honestly.
Nice. Okay. So it sounds like it was a really great experience, a fun environment. Was it just that you weren't like aware that you could go further with it? Or did you feel like the people in your life were like, hey, you need to focus on more reasonable, realistic things than this board game that you're spending time on?
I mean, I had trouble studying, so I can understand that it wasn't my parents' first priority, shall we say.
Okay, gotcha.
They were definitely more pressing matters. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm kind of lucky that way. My children both just naturally do very well at school. So then I'm very supportive of my daughter's chess. It just complements her school, is how I see it. But, you know, everyone's different, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So did you give up chess completely then, or did you just kind of keep it on the back burner for a while?
That's a nice question. Well, there was some unfortunate family events that kept me from playing chess. At the age of 16, up to, let's say, I don't know, I am around 30 at the time of recording. So we'll say I joined chess again at about, let's say, 27, 3 or 4 years ago, more or less.
Okay.
I played other games in the meantime, but it just didn't felt like they were fulfilling enough. I needed something with more staying power and less patches, if that
yeah,
makes sense.
It does. I went through that as well, where like I stopped playing chess because I wanted to go back to grad school, but I wanted the competition, so I started playing card games. And it would be like every time someone would draw the right card and I would draw the wrong card, I'd be like, why can't this be more like chess? This is so annoying. And then eventually I was like, why don't I just play chess? Like, that seems like a good idea.
Exactly. I went through some phases, one with League of Legends, another one with StarCraft 2. After the StarCraft 2 one, I realized that this game is too complex in real time for my liking. And it's kind of chess-like, depending on compositions and play. So if I want that aspect, you know, you can actually go back to chess. And by the way, a friend of mine inspired me, who was and still is. I am also an amateur player, but he still is as well. And the Queen's Gambit kind of, there were a lot of new players surging, let's put it that way. And I realized if they're adults and they want to actually get back into chess, compared to these people, I actually have something that I can fall back on, my previous training and some more games under my back. I actually started with classical game. I never got much farther than, I don't know, rapid games or something. And they still feel lightning fast to me, I have to say.
Nice. Okay. So you are, from the beginning of coming back, it was pretty much all over the board.
Basically, yeah. I started playing. I know it was basically a decade after Kasparov lost to Deep Blue. So there were computers, but people didn't trust them yet.
Yeah.
I know that for a lot of people, that sounds like a foreign concept. I understand chess has fundamentally changed.
Yeah.
Also, the way I approach the game has changed. So, you know, I kind of try to get with the times. That being said, It just wasn't like that.
Hmm.
I know you get it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Back when I played, the computer was very suspect. You could trick it. And like, especially if it was like some 20, I move 21, it might miss it, right? And all this stuff. And yeah, I remember those days. I'm curious. So you said you play a lot of over the board and you don't play online. Do you bring the computer in to like analyze your games over the board? Or are you just like, computers, you're dead to me. This is the first time I've even booted up a computer in a while. Like, what's your relationship with these monstrous machines?
Yeah, that's. I haven't honestly thought about it too much, even though it's a central piece of playing chess at this point. I do tend to analyze. A lot of times I analyze without the engine, when I can avoid the temptation and when I'm not too tired to figure out complex tactical positions. I do tend to fall back on them. Sometimes I do online play, but not too often. Playing once a week and analyzing the game, and perhaps sometimes twice a week and analyzing the games, kind of just soaks up the vast amount of my time.
Okay.
So I can't often just dwell in the computer. Plus, I am very keen on understanding why I play some moves. So unless a variation I can actually understand, I usually pay it no mind, if that makes sense.
Okay. Interesting. Do you use a coach at all to help you understand? Like, if you're really trying to seek understanding, do you bring in other people? Do you have higher rated people that you work with, a coach, anyone who helps you find this understanding?
Yeah, I have a couple of sources actually. If I can understand the computer by myself and it helps to blunder check, that's obviously one way. I do tend to get some lessons. Let me shout out JJ at this point,
okay,
a well known figure in chess Twitter.
This is JJ Lang.
Yeah, yeah.
From the one Chess and only. Feels podcast?
Yes, yes, that one. The famous JJ Lang.
Yeah, JJ's great.
Yeah, they really are. I also tend to listen to their Chess Journey episodes a lot because basically it was one episode. Anyways, but it was a great episode and it has a lot of things to learn from. They tend to look at my games and tell me the patterns, the damaging patterns they notice. As most people, I suffer from a lack of patience. Let's not beat around that bush.
Yeah.
And I do tend to blunder a lot sometimes when I'm not focused. That's also true.
Yeah, we all do, right?
Yeah. There are some moments especially during the opening where it's just, I haven't sipped my coffee enough and things just, they're just pieces of wood flying around. I don't understand chess at that point. So there's this. I also have joined the dojo during the last 6 months. This has been fun. I have positive things and experiences about that. Although I do approach it with some caution because I am not convinced that the conversion from online quick chess to classical over the board can actually be a thing that exists.
Oh, so for you, it's not even that the number conversion is slightly off. It's you shouldn't even do it at all.
I would like not to be hardcore like that, let's be honest, but I have noticed that the quality of play and the things that work in rapid online games are very different to the ones that I tend to encounter over the board.
Yeah.
There are some moves that look iffy, but I need to have a 10-minute discussion with myself before figuring out why they're iffy.
Yeah.
And I can actually do that in classical over the board multiple times. Whereas in rapid, I just see a move, pray, and hope that it works. I do calculate. Let
yeah.
it be known. But if something is iffy for a reason that I don't understand, I don't have the time to figure it out.
Yeah. I totally agree with that. There's been so many rapid games I've played where I've gone like, oh, this is such a fascinating position. I wish this was a classical game and I could spend 15 minutes right now examining what is clearly the most critical position. Instead, I get three. I'm going to give myself 3 minutes and I will not figure this out and I'm going to get the best I can. Yeah, it can be very unsatisfying at times.
Yeah, that really is. By the way, sometimes I get this in classical games where I'm like, why is this not in the analysis board so I can spend 30 minutes on the variation?
Yeah,
and you know, because I cannot count like more than, I don't know, five moves at the best of times. Let's not act better than that. So, you know, if there are multiple variations that change pawn structures and the like, it's usually kind of a tall order for me to be able to completely understand the complicated position, even over the board.
Yeah, that can be really tough. I'm curious, when you say over the board, what kind of time control are we talking about? Are we talking about the fabled European, like, one game a week, take your time? I mean, like, one game a day, tournaments that take a week. Like, what are we looking at here?
Exactly that, though it's mostly these once every week, 90-30s.
Ooh, nice.
But when there are time, when I have time off, and well, my girlfriend, which, you know, she'll probably listen to this, so hello, love you. You know, let's give her a little bit of a shout out. When there is time and things are, and I can just do it, sometimes I can have the luxury of playing these fabled ones one per day. Though I usually have to mix in some work with that. So it's not the pure, I just play once and it's my afternoon thingy and then I can rest.
Okay, so it's you like do a work day and then go play the game.
Yeah, usually it's something like that. In the once per day for a full week, that's obviously not feasible. I've done it once with horrible results.
Yeah.
I just couldn't focus. It was a big, huge problem. I need to take at least a couple of days off for such an event.
Okay. What is the Greek chess scene like?
I mean, it's interesting because being in Greece, you often don't have to answer this question, as you understand. And I've mostly listened to podcasts when they describe the US chess scene. So having to do the reverse process is a new one, as you understand. That being said, there are... I do not like the rating system. It shouldn't be the first thing I say, but I don't like the rating system. Imagine a system which is like... FIDE people are underrated, okay? That's basically a fact. You subtract about 100 points from that, and you update the rating once every 6 months.
Oh, gee.
Get a close approximation to the Greek rating system. I'm not familiar with the exact rules, but that's basically it. Imagine you starting for 6 months and you still have the same rating.
Yeah, that's very strange. Okay.
It really is. And if me and you is kind of a thing starting for 6 months, imagine a kid doing that.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Those kids must be so underrated.
It's they're so underrated. It's actually hilarious. I don't even know what to say about that.
Yeah.
I had a kid which is like 1200 FIDE and should be about 1150 Greek rating. And they played, I'm saying instantly. When I say instantly, I completely mean instantly, 13 moves of closed Spanish theory.
Yeah.
They even played the D3 variation, which doesn't allow for the open Spanish.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't do any inaccuracy, so they didn't punish that. But every time I made a move, they made the correct counter move in regards to what I understood from the position. I only won because I managed to cook up a position that happened again when we took our moves back, as in we moved our knights back and forth, in which my queen was actually covering the kid's knight square. So I managed to grab the free knight, and then they kind of completely collapsed.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I was 50 minutes behind and very stressed and very hard pressed as black.
Yeah, those kids that move instantly, it's really kind of unnerving because, first of all, it puts this pressure on you. But then, second of all, I feel like it's an added pressure of, like, I can't lose to someone that moves instantly. Like, I actually feel this pressure of having to find the move that punishes their style of moving instantly. I don't know if you felt that pressure at all.
I used to do that, but then I realized what a lot of people have said, that playing too fast is actually a time mismanagement, and I'm not obligated to try and find some magical punish, especially since if they play it instantly, there's a decent amount of chance that it's a theory move, so it shouldn't have a punishment. Yeah. That being said, I also understand that I'm kind of a slow player, so I don't. There's no point rushing me. I will just make a worse move.
Gotcha.
Okay. I just try to not stay too far behind. My real issue with my opponent playing instantly is that I cannot spend the opponent's time to make general board observations.
Yeah.
I understand the position much worse, and I suffer time for understanding my position and what I'm supposed to play.
Yeah. So does it sound like you subscribe to that school of thought that says on your move, you should be making concrete calculations, and then on your opponent's move, it's more like figuring out what's going on in the position, seeing the patterns, seeing possibilities, and not as much making concrete moves?
Exactly, exactly. I mean, I can have two or three variations at hand just for the obvious moves. You know, one move that if the opponent plays something completely irrelevant, I can play quickly. I need that, especially versus kids. One move that is the critical variation is the one that I need to be taking care of. And then a couple of generic observations.
Okay.
I just try to do my best with the opponent's time.
Yeah. Are there a lot of tournaments? Like, are you in the Athens area or are you in a different part of Greece?
I live in Athens,
Oh, nice.
which surprisingly, Athens chess scene is less vibrant than another city of Greece, Thessaloniki. This is
Oh.
supposed to, it used to host, the, it hosted once the Olympiad in Thessaloniki. And it's kind of, what's the word? It's the chess capital of Greece, Thessaloniki.
Okay.
However, that being said, there are a lot of tournaments in Athens. Some during Saturdays, mornings, evenings, some during Wednesdays. You're bound to find a day that can fit your style if you are about making that time to play a 9:30 game over the board.
Okay, that's cool. I think I spent about 4 days in Athens once. Very, very enjoyable. I know I we haven't talked about this. So in my graduate work, the primary language I studied was ancient Greek. Not modern Greek. I don't know modern Greek, but I was pretty proficient in ancient Greek. So
maybe you've mentioned it once. It doesn't strike me as completely new information, but I could be making this up. I'm not going to lie about it. There's about a 40% chance that I'm just making this up. But I'm glad to know you studied the ancient variation of the language. There's a decent chance that you probably know it way better than I do, because it wasn't something I was required to delve particularly deep in. I studied mathematics in university, so
Gotcha.
It was not something that I needed to dwell on. And earlier study years is just earlier study years. You can only do so much with
Yeah,
that.
yeah, for sure. All right. let's talk about how much time you have each week, because you said earlier on, like, you really only have time to play your over the board games and to do some analysis. So how much time are you able to carve out, like, per day or per week to do your studying or to play chess?
I go per weeks because days are not an estimate I want to go by. Some days need to be empty for other reasons, some for rest reasons. So I try not to limit myself like that in thinking about chess. Depending on the week, I can go from the lowest being about 10 hours. I don't think I ever go lower than 10 hours, up to, let's say, 20 hours in a great week.
Okay.
That being said, my average would actually be about 15, maybe 16, depending on weeks.
Okay. So it sounds like if you're doing like 15 hours a week average, you're playing what, like maybe 3 to 6 hours doing analysis. What are you doing on top of that then? Do you do any just straight studying?
Okay, let's see. There is obviously at least 3 hours, which should be my OTB game. Maybe 6 hours if I'm playing twice per week. There is about, depending on the position and how well I know the game that was being played, I can spend from a minimum of 45 minutes, which is actually unrealistic, not gonna lie about it, to a maximum of about 3 hours per game that I analyze said game.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, this is where I gain my theoretical knowledge from. If it's something I cannot understand or can't find the reason behind, I just tend not to memorize theory.
Okay.
Some people could call it a minus. I am not fond of doing the memorizing, so I don't think about it.
So it sounds like your opening study comes organically as a result of looking at your own games, seeing where you went wrong, trying to figure out a better plan, a better move in a spot.
Exactly, more or less that's about it. I also know, you know, maybe a famous game played in such a position if I'm lucky enough to have played good enough moves, some generic plans. There's also the issue that I've been an E4 and then E5 player for ever since I started playing, so we can add about a decade of experience playing E5 and the Italian. It hasn't been the most high level experience, but you know, you can tend to gather some insights about the positions you play if you play them long enough.
Yeah, that's definitely the big bonus of not switching openings, right? It's like,
yeah,
if you don't switch openings, you get more and more and more knowledge until suddenly you're an expert.
Hopefully. Hopefully.
We hope. Okay, so you look at your games. Do you do any like tactical work with puzzles or anything like that?
Of course. Well, most of my other training, disregarding playing over the board and starting my set games, it comes from either homework that's been left from JJ or, you know, someone. There are also the dojo recommendations, which I do tend to take somewhat seriously. As in regards to, you know, if I have nothing to study, that's why I signed up to the dojo. I get to have a study plan.
Yeah.
And there are also games or people whose games I want to take a look at. But this usually comes, you know, it's my third or fourth priority. It's not really something that I often can indulge myself.
Okay. Let's say you have 20 minutes to study. Where are you going first?
I do have Jennifer Sahara's new book, so I'm gonna get on those mates to finish them up. And then we're gonna start considering other stuff. Usually I get chunks of about an hour, which is a privilege. I completely understand it.
Nice.
But if I have an hour and I'm not into doing something very particular, I usually do tactics. I do enjoy tactics, and I actually prefer tactics from books. I, you know, hearing me say these things, I realize that my approach is very old school, I have to say. But I do love these tactics organized by theme. I
Okay.
feel that's important to my understanding and the way my mind figures out things.
Okay. Like seeing the same theme over and over and over helps you cement that pattern more easily.
Exactly. It helps me understand what the thing's about, and it helps me. If I look at a particularly juicy tactic, I'm like, oh yeah, that was on the pin section. That knight maneuver was sweet. Maybe I can do that somehow.
Gotcha. Yeah. So there's some sort of story that comes along with that. Like I remember the section it was in as well as just the pattern.
Exactly. It wasn't just a random double attacking move. It was that one move that Susan Polgar played in that one game in her book that she showed, for example.
Okay. Nice. Yeah. I do some of that as well, especially with names of patterns. So like the Checkmate's pattern manual has been very helpful for me to attach names to all these random patterns that I had seen. But now if I can say like, it's an epaulette mate, my brain just has like this whole other thing it can tap into.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, I have yet to memorize all these patterns. I did do a very sincere try of learning these patterns, but I just did some repetitions a lot of times, and I then gave up on learning the names because I forgot.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. I think for some people, the names are important because it's like a story. For other people, maybe it's completely irrelevant. For you, it sounds like maybe even the color of a section does something for your brain. So like, you know, I that's what's so fascinating about the human brain and chess improvement. When you hear someone say like, this is the only way to do it, it's like, woo, our brains are all different. I don't know. It seems like there's a lot of possibilities here.
I mean, if kids can learn from playing Blitz, then I'm sure we can figure out some other way as well.
Yeah, that's the most maddening thing of all. So how did you go from 1200 to 1800? A lot of Blitz games. Ugh.
No, I never reached 1800. 13, I said 13. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm saying little kids can do that sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They
yeah.
tend to do that. Usually their answers involve Blitz.
Yeah. It's
and
very maddening.
Yeah.
If I had a whole podcast that was just interviewing kids, it'd all be kids talking about how they play a lot of Blitz. And then I would have to cancel the show. It'd be terrible. All right. So what tactics books are the ones that you found especially useful then?
Okay, if I have to give names, which I will gladly do.
Okay.
I did love, of course, the 5334, the one with the Polgar image.
Okay, the giant book, the giant
the big
Dojo
one.
Polgar.
Yeah, book. That's great. And what's great is that I will try to, whenever I graduate, which I just did, I'm going to start the whole book over again.
Oh,
because
wow.
It's just nice. I do tend to do some chess books two times, maybe three if I can.
Okay.
I do have a Greek one, which you probably won't be able to find, which is just like 109, I think 109 exercises, which is separated by mating patterns.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
So it's like a handheld, you know, chess mates manual or something.
Mm-hmm.
There is the Chess Tactics for Champions, which was actually my favorite, one of my favorite ones from the Polgar, from Susan Polgar. This one was Susan's work.
Okay.
I really like this one. So far, I really enjoyed Jennifer Sahari's one. Honorable mentions are, of course,
is that Shahari one, the new one, Play Like a Champion?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the new one. I got it, you know, like a week ago. I haven't gotten too deep into it because with playing the games and analyzing them, usually I don't have a lot of spare time, but I have gotten probably up to the mates in threes, which is not like great progress, but you know, for an hour or two of starting, it has been nice so far, and it's nice to see games and variations from people you actually recognize.
Yeah,
that actually makes it very fun, I have to say.
Yeah, that's cool. Nice. Okay, so it sounds like you've got a bunch of tactics books you've been sort of working through. I feel like that the Giant Polgar book needs to have like a in the next time they publish it, it should have a big sticker that says like recommended by the Chess Dojo or something.
Yes. I thought about it a little bit, but it's a clean yes from me.
Okay, let's see. How about end games? Do you work on end games at all, or are you just like end games come from my game analysis and that's how I learn end games?
Okay, I guess it's time to get into a little bit of more controversial stuff. I do not like too much Silman's endgame manual.
What?
I'm so sorry, but I think it's good, okay? First things first, it's good. And if you have no other resource, let that be the one, you know?
Okay.
But I think it kind of trivializes the importance of plans and long-term pressuring, especially on equal positions. It does show some techniques, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. I let that be known. I also study it every now and then. Every 2 or 3 months, I go up to the section that's above my rating just to make sure that I'm still in touch.
Okay.
But that being said, it just doesn't help me generate the kind of ideas and plays that analyzing my endgames does, or that I actually used to join a group chess class which gave us positions from the ECE books. I don't know if you remember or know them.
I don't think I do.
ECO is the Encyclopedia of Chess Openings.
Yeah.
ECE is the Encyclopedia of Chess Endings.
Oh, I've never even heard of that. Okay.
Yeah, that's actually great. And it poses a lot of different positions. What happens in this rook pawn endgame if the rook is on that square, on that square, on that square, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm.
And what it helps you realize as you play through this position is that it forces you to learn the tricks of the end games. For example, sometimes you have to sack the rook for the pawn because your king is trapped inside, so it becomes a stalemate. Otherwise, you don't manage to draw that end game.
Yeah.
There's a specific one. I cannot play it from heart, I have to say. And so it forces you to analyze this position and work through them. And in working through these positions, you actually gain a very good understanding of how the end game is supposed to be working. Maybe I don't know them so well to be able to tell you if they're winning or not, but I can tell you that if an endgame is winning, this is the way in which it will be winning.
Okay.
I have to play this sort of a plan.
Gotcha.
And in that regard, I unfortunately find kind of lacking the Silman's endgame manual. But in general, it's a great book, I have to say. It's
okay.
Not my cup of tea exactly.
Yeah.
I
agree with that. I think it's trying to do something a little different, right? It's trying to give you those kind of building blocks. And I had the same observation about my own game. Like, I went through that and I was like, cool, I know a bunch of stuff. Also, I don't know how to play end games. So it's that interesting thing where it gives you the tools, but not like that broader picture of how to plan and scheme in an end game.
Exactly. I've heard you're a huge proponent of Serosevsky's Endgame Manual.
Yeah, Shereshevsky was the book for me that taught me how to plan, and then Silman's book taught me the building blocks.
I see. I have gotten my hands on the 110 Games You Must Know. When I get some time, which is a big when, we'll see when this when comes along, I'll start actually playing and teaching some of them to that amateur friend of mine who helped me get back on that saddle. We go together through the logical chess move by move. Yeah, a book which
Nice.
has been completely transformative for my chess in a year, in a way which I kind of didn't think could happen, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Why was it so transformative, do you think?
So this revelation came to me in a lesson with JJ combined with reading that book.
Okay.
JJ was always telling me how you mustn't trade pieces unless the trade is forced.
Yeah.
It's in your favor. These are the two reasons.
Yep.
And in your favor basically means you either trade the opponent's best light piece or you trade your worst light piece.
Yeah.
No other trade should be done, basically. I
Yeah.
know it sounds very rough, it's very rough around the edges, but it was this was how I was able to understand it, let's say. So what ended up happening was, I also have another theory which I have to share. You've heard of The Art of Attack, the
Yes.
famous book by Vukovic, of course. I sincerely believe that logical chess move by move is the art of attack, but mini for lower rated players.
Oh, okay.
Because all of the games in there is like you force the opponent to move a pawn in front of their king. Let's see how they die.
Okay, gotcha. So because so many of those games are attacking games, it's kind of like the art of the attack for beginners.
Yes, exactly. So what ended up happening with these two building blocks is that I kept more pieces on my side of the board
Okay.
and I threw them at the opponent's king together with an F pawn, not an F pawn, an H pawn.
Yeah.
And it's working a surprising amount of times.
Okay, nice.
If you manage to close off the position, gather your pieces and throw them at the opponent's king,
Yeah.
they often tend to, if anything, defend badly and give you a better end game.
Yep. Yeah, and I think even if the attack isn't sound, one of the hardest things to do in chess is defend against an attack, right? Because if you make one misstep, you may be done for.
Exactly, which is how I beat the one person that was 1740 feeder, and I beat them. I threw my H pawn on them together with like three or four minor pieces, a couple of rooks, maybe put a queen in there, and they misplayed one move. My queen got inside. They remove. I got rid. Basically, they captured away from the G file with their G pawn,
Okay.
and then it was pain, they got in time pressure, they blundered, they lost.
Defending attacks is the hardest thing. I have this horrible habit. I've tried to take on the thing of like, don't fear being attacked, only be worried if it's a good attack. So people will do these amazing attacks on me. I'll be like, ah, it's nothing. And my coach is like, nothing. They have four pieces in front of your king. How is that nothing? And I'm like, I fear nothing, coach.
I mean, why would you fear? If you die, you die. If you win, you win. Simple as
Yeah, exactly.
that.
All right. Any other books that have been helpful? Any strategy books or anything like that?
I went through Simple Chess. It was great. I loved it a lot. That being said, it was kind of a bit higher level than I would like it to be for a person that never touched another strategy book and had no previous notion of strategy,
Okay.
like
Which book
I
was this?
did. Simple Chess by Steen.
Oh yeah. Simple chess is not simple chess. Simple chess is like pretty advanced chess.
Yeah, I actually loved it and it was great,
Yeah.
but it just didn't have the effect that logical chess move by move had on me.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think simple chess is like your second strategy book. Like you read like Chess Strategy for Kids by Coakley. And then when you really understand all that, then you move to something like simple chess.
I can probably get behind that. I'll give it another read eventually.
Okay. Yeah.
Eventually is the operating word in this sentence, I have to
Yeah.
say.
I understand. You probably took something away from Simple Chess, but certainly not all the nuances. Like there's some pretty advanced topics like space. That is a tough topic to have as like your first strategy book.
Yeah, I was able to use some of that space things, but let's not act like I'm able to control space. I'm obviously not. What was interesting was the way that open and half open files were used. I really enjoyed that one. The outpost part, the attacking chess complexes, I actually liked. I do remember the chapters. Like I even kept notes on this thing.
Oh,
It's a very
nice.
tiny book, you know, but
Yeah.
it took me closer to like 30 hours or something to
Okay.
go through it. I kept taking notes, noting on the page. I just did everything to absorb as much of it as possible. And a lot of it was helpful, but maybe not one's first strategy book.
Yeah. Yep. I totally agree with that. I'm glad I read it as my second strategy, or actually more like my third strategy book. So when I read it, I was like, all right, this is great. It's just complementing what I already know. Okay, I'm curious about the chess dojo though. So you have this amazing coach, JJ Lang, and then you join the chess dojo. Do they like compete to give you advice, or is it like JJ gives you one type of advice and then the chess dojo gives you like resources and positions to play through?
So usually my top thing to do is to play and analyze my games. After that, I get help from JJ on a per as needed basis. And whenever there is another topic that I want to delve into, it gets inspired by the dojo basically.
Okay.
So I tend to mix these three things. It's usually it's always my over the board games and the analysis first. The other two, it kind of depends on what are my plans. If I desperately need another new book to delve into, then it's Chess Dojo time. If I want to do tactics, then it's also Chess Dojo time. If I want to work on specific openings or see specific example games, then it's JJ homework time.
Okay, gotcha. So you haven't like adopted the opening repertoire that the chess dojo suggests.
Well, I have to give a shout out to the Easy System by Jesse Cry, of course. But
Okay.
other than that, it's mostly my own stuff, unless I have completely zero idea on how to play something.
Okay.
And then I do take a look at the dojo, maybe, I don't know, maybe an online resource or something.
Cool. I'm just always curious how people mix the dojo, which is awesome, with their own coach who might have different ideas. It can be challenging to have those multiple coaches involved. I have my own coach. I use the chess dojo for some things. I use the chess gym for some things, and it's like I'm blending all these approaches together. Yeah, I was just curious how you did it. Okay, so let's see. One of the things you talked to me about ahead of time was that you are working hard to try to bring more women into chess. What has sort of inspired this goal of yours?
Well, being a trans person and a non-passing trans person, I actually have a great interest in bringing more women into chess. That being said, if it's a more welcoming place for women, then it can way easier become a more welcoming place for me. I cannot act like a fierce stance on the transgender issues is anything less than unacceptable. And bringing more women, especially from any kind of minority background or group, can help with that. Because they just see things that other people would not be able to understand.
Okay, excellent.
Usually the way I approach this is it's mostly been friends so far. You know, I haven't had any commissions or tutored anyone. I'm not gonna, even though I would like to pick up teaching chess one day, it does come naturally to me. I'm not gonna act like I can have long-term solutions to problems of learning chess. That being said, I usually do a mix of, I don't know, let's see, 12 to 24 hours of teaching chess to a person, teaching them the rules from scratch, a couple of basic checkmates, some opening principles to get them going, asking about their worst pieces so they can get a feel about the middle game. Just basic introduction stuff so they can play an actual game of chess. And then I give them a couple of pointers on where they can turn. Should I not be available or our lessons come to an end? Mostly it's let's just let's not lie about that. And maybe give them a tournament-sized chessboard with chess pieces and the chess book. So they can, you know, they can play chess by themselves or with friends.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. And do you have a lot of women friends that you've been able to bring into chess then?
Unfortunately, no. And I can't say that the Greek Federation of Chess is not at fault for their decisions. They have done a thing where you have to actually pay 10 euros to be considered an active athlete and be able to participate in over-the-board tournaments.
Yeah.
But that's not the actual problem. Should it be only 10 euros, then it would still be not cool because it doesn't help promoting to newer players. But you actually also have to be a member of a chess club to be able to partake in the tournaments and play and pay those 10 euros, which basically means you have to sign up, you have to get doctor papers to check on you and say you are fit to play chess, which is a funny situation to be in, but it's a thing that happens. And then you have to actually pay the annual fee for the chess club. So if you're a new player, in order to play an over-the-board tournament, it's not just paying 30 euros or something. It's seeing doctors, paying a decent amount of time, paying an annual subscription, and on top of that, 10 extra euros. So basically, I haven't brought people to over-the-board chess. That being said, I have actually brought like 3 or 4 people to some online chess. They brought them some appreciation for chess in their life. I show people the Morphe Opera game, of course, to get them to see how beautiful it can be to play attacking chess and understand pieces and coordination, things like that.
Wow. That is a fascinatingly high bar to get people to over the board, right? Like you have to be so committed to want to do all that. You're like, I just wanted to play a game of chess. And they're like, oh, no. You got to jump through all these hoops. I can see why it would be hard to get newer players who are just like, I want to stick my toe in the pool. It feels like you can't put your toe in. You have to jump all the way in if you want to play.
Exactly. And that's even if you want to play some random blitz or rapid tournament.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is a very big commitment. I can see why it would be challenging to get people into it.
Of course.
Well, it sounds like you're really carving out a great process here for helping new players, and it sounds like you're bringing people in. So the more different people we can get into chess, the better, right?
For me, yeah, clearly, yes.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I have my own daughter that, you know, I'm working with her, and it's that thing of when we go to the tournaments, it's like she wants to have a friend, and she's still that age where she would much rather hang out with kids of her own gender. And so then, you know, it's like the gender gap becomes very apparent when it's like, well, I guess your choice of friends at this tournament is going to be rather small, right? It'd be great to have more little girls here than little boys. So something we're cognizant of as well.
Yeah, it's not much different in Greece. A lot of times there are no female players in a tournament.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so, or maybe it's one, at best like 2 or 3 women playing in the tournament. It's just, it could be better. Let's put it that way.
I'd say the U.S. is interesting, where Scholastic or little kids tournaments, there's quite a few little girls. We're not near 50-50, but like there's enough where you're like, okay, there's quite a few. And then when you go to big tournaments, there's quite a few females, but a lot of them are on the younger side, right? It's that like maybe 7 to 14 is where most of the female chess players come in. And then at the higher boards, you have some really advanced women players. But to me, the biggest concern is like those bottom 3 sections. There's very few adult women, which would be at the spot, I think, where that shows us like how many newer women players were able to get into chess, right? Those would be the bottom board, and we're just not very successful there.
Exactly. I think the same thing.
Yeah. Did you see, I just got an email from the USCF the other day about like FIDE is going to be running these women-only tournaments online with $1,000 prizes a week or something. Like, was that right? Did I misread that? That sounds kind of cool.
I've heard about this. I have not received an email, I have to say. Maybe I'm not subscribed to the right mailing list. That's actually a possibility, I have to say. But other than that, yeah, I kind of heard of it. I am optimistic, but as always, cautiously optimistic, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I can agree with that. Also, it doesn't really fix the problem or address the problem at all of bringing beginner women into chess, right? This is addressing more the problem of having an outlet for the elite women chess players to be able to earn more money, which is wonderful. I'm all for that. But finding a way to bring in beginners is great also.
That's great for player retention, but bringing new women into the sport will actually require different measures. And I don't have good solutions or proposals for that. I'm not going to lie about it.
Yeah, it sounds like you're making an effort, though, and you have your own process to help individuals, which I think is great.
Yeah, as far as I can get them, I try my best.
Okay. Well, Anna, this has been a great interview. It's fun to talk to someone who is so focused on over-the-board chess. I tell myself I am, and then I look at my week, and it's like I had the time to play the one over-the-board game, and then like five rapid games online and 20 more blitz games online, and I'm like, I play most of my games online, don't I? So I'm really impressed that you're able to really take that time to play your over the board games, really examine them closely, you know, use the rest of your time to study and only play a little online. So that's impressive stuff.
Thank you so much for having me. And at the end of the day, if you're playing an over the board game each week and analyzing it, that's about as much as one adult can expect, basically.
Yeah, that's fair. Okay. Well, thanks so much. For those of you out there, I hope this is a week where you gain, I don't know, maybe you go to sleep and you wake up with 200 more rating points. That sounds awesome. I hope the USCF does that. This will be amazing. But if not, if it's a normal week where you're plateauing or even losing all your rating points, I'm so sorry. And come back next week and we'll have another guest to help you on your journey. Bye-bye, everybody.